Welcome to the second part of my interview with Steve Connolly, most recently from Hodder Education, where we talk about trends in the digital space, both in education and more broadly. So welcome, Steve. Steve, in our previous conversation, we were talking about the launch of your new platform at Hodder Education, Boost, and recently left Hodder. And I wanted to continue really our discussion into the trends we're both seeing through our children and through ourselves in the online space, and you know, what we envision for the future for our children and the sort of broader education environment as a whole. And so here we start talking about our kids, and I hope it's interesting to everyone. My daughter's 12. She's been doing a lot of online school, and I'm very conscious that her expectations are now completely changed in the way that she's going to learn. She's an obsessive YouTuber, TikToker, all those kind of things. And one of the things that that's made me think about is, and with these kind of educational resources, what are her expectations going to be of universities, of postgrad experience, of sharing research and sharing, you know, even fiction creations that she might come up with later. It's not all about written word. And I think it'll be very difficult for the pupils of today to move into what's a very wordy environment on transition to university. And I wondered if, sorry, this is a very long-winded question, but I wondered if from your perspective, where you've seen changes in user behavior, you think generationally is going to shift what these kids kind of expect of us in the future?
I think that's a really interesting question, because a lot of kids, if my youngest son, who's still at school, is to go by, they were trying to grapple with the challenge of just not being at school.
Yes.
I think beyond that, I think the bigger question is, how do textbooks get used?
Yes, okay.
And what does that mean for publishers? I'm coming at it from a publishing perspective. What does that mean for publishers in the longer term, in terms of whether textbooks, which have traditionally been bought, I think, essentially as a framework, particularly at the higher curriculum levels, where you've got high stakes exams, they're a very good encapsulation of the key things you need to know to pass an exam. And or rather, that's a very basic distillation. Actually, for a really good textbook, it should be about explanation, exploration, skills development, those kind of things. But ultimately, it's built around the framework of a curriculum, and a teacher will use that resource in very different ways. In some ways, digital is no different. It's just that the multi-dimensional characteristic of digital, I mean, books are linear, they give you a pathway through, but they are essentially components bolted together. If you think of your average textbook, you've got a box that does this and a piece of narrative that does that and a diagram
and a
that does this.
That's right.
So there is sort of, it's explanation, exploration, reiteration, testing, you know, those kind of things. Digital is a catch-all phrase for so many different things.
Yes.
And I think probably what will be interesting is whether AI and machine learning combined with different elements of content, which deliver different aspects of teaching and learning, can really come together so that when a pupil is learning, whether it's in a flipped classroom scenario or whether it's for an exam or preparing, trying to figure out what they've got to revise for their exam, that it really does give them an insight in terms of what they do and don't understand, how to get a better understanding of those things, how to check that their understanding is correct and that they are developing the right skills, and that leading to a successful outcome for them personally. And that's, we're not there. Because
early days, in a way.
Well, I think it's still, if the pandemic's taught us anything, there is a massive importance of teachers.
Yes, in all of this.
They are the key mediators.
Yes.
And if there had been something that could do what we've been talking about, first of all, you want the personal contact. You want to be able to do what we're doing. You want to be able to talk face to face, ideally, or failing that on a Zoom call or a team. But AI doesn't currently deliver that experience. It's about people, human interaction. But what AI could start to do, I think, if we can find common methodologies for doing this and sort of baseline principles that people can adopt and adhere to. And by that, it could be just simple protocols, being able to get different types of content to interact with one another, to a framework, and that AI can pick that up. Because at the moment, AI tends to work around the principle of something that works within a platform. So you're immediately in that platform. You're not able not to connected. Utilize, you're not able to utilize other things. I'm talking in very general terms. So if it's changed any habits, I think it's there's an expectation or less of a nervousness for pupils to get into an online platform, get a piece of content, use it, and then move on. Do I think that teachers are now fully comfortable, fully digitally literate, really happy to engage? No, I don't. I think that a lot of them are firefighting in very, very difficult circumstances and largely doing a very good job of it. And they should be applauded for that. So I haven't really answered your question. And I guess that's
It's a good discussion point. That's basically what's come of it.
I guess the answer is I don't entirely know.
Right.
But I think with better analytics and better observation of behavior, what we should be able to see is what do people value as part of a rounded education and part of a rounded service. And that's probably the key thing to understand.
It feels like the ecosphere is kind of fragmented at the moment in the nicest possible way. And I don't mean that to undermine what the resources that are out there, because they're, you know, MS Teams is excellent, Google is excellent. There's loads of educational resources which are excellent. But what they don't do is fit together well and provide a user experience across the whole ecosphere. And I think the research publishing environment has worked very hard to connect those things with services like Mendeley, for example, which is read, share, contribute, you know, edit, write, all those kind of things. But within the secondary and primary sectors, it doesn't feel like the pupils are in a world, if you like, that's connected together. What they are is because my daughter, for example, spent 6 hours a day on online lessons. Now that was really challenging for the teacher because in all honesty, most of them were on mute with their video off, and guess what they had in their hand? So they weren't paying attention. It would have been exceptionally difficult to, you know, have the high level of engagement that they would have in a classroom. And so I think as a kind of educational tool provider, we need to move to a circumstance where you can get immediate feedback from your audience, you know. So one of the things I was thinking about recently was conference presentations. I've been to a gazillion conferences online this year, and I've spoken at two or three as well. The difficult thing as a speaker is understanding the reaction of your audience. When you're in a room, in a classroom, in a lecture theatre, you can sense what the audience thinks of you. You know, it's like the comedian bombing on stage. You can feel when people are drifting away, when they've just started to look at their computers. And so I was thinking there's really simple things, like you could have a smiley face kind of button, and the teacher says, quick, vote now, smile or not, you know, those kind of things. And it's that kind of interaction, that two-way engagement that I think we can facilitate as technology people. But maybe we just haven't got that far because, you know, the remote working, remote learning universe hasn't really graduated to being, you know, fully fledged yet.
So in response to your question about, you know, interaction and reaction, and being able to, as a speaker, gauge your audience and be able to sense check where they're at any given point. Teams did actually develop quite quickly during the pandemic to the point where they added all sorts of features to try and enable that kind of interaction. Mm-hmm. I think you're right that this highlights the absolute importance of human contact in a way, because you can pick up an atmosphere in a room. You can read an audience. You can see the person who's disengaged or really engaged. Mm-hmm. And that's really very difficult in the virtual sphere. But to your point about everything talking to one another, I think the natural conclusion to all of this, you know, we're starting to see it with things like content sharing and single sign-on, but the real power will come where the level of integration between different providers of services continues.
Yes.
Because schools don't work on the basis of a HODA solution or a Pearson solution or a Collins solution or a mm-hmm. Cambridge solution. They work on the basis of having to deliver a curriculum.
Yes.
And having to engage with pupils and making sure that they're getting access to the things that they need when they need them. Mm-hmm. And so this is where the real challenge comes in for I think for teachers, but also for pupils and for publishers, mm-hmm. in that we as commercial providers are in competition with one another, but we're also trying to, quite honestly, and I really do firmly believe this, serve the best interests of the teachers yeah. and learners. But sometimes we're not doing that because we are not cooperating as well as we could be in that space, yeah. I think. And funnily enough, in relation to the assessment services that Hodda publishes and that for which there's a big platform, one of the key things has been to try and ensure that if a school wants to take the sort of top level bits of data mm-hmm. and push them through to a centralized marking or data tracker,
yeah.
that they can combine with teacher judgments and sources of information from other places, that should yes. be facilitated. And we're starting to do that. And you're seeing that with kind of the single sign-on as well. So
yeah.
it's starting to happen, I think. There are yes. sort of areas of real, well, real step forwards and real development yeah. in that.
Fantastic. Well, that's yeah. really good to hear. The other sector I've been working in, area I've been working in, is diversity and inclusion over mm. the last year or so. And particularly thinking about conditions like dyslexia, for example, what kind of accessibility standards did you aim for and why did you select?
Well, we went for AA, you know, the I think it was
yes.
the second highest tier of accessibility.
Yes,
that
yes
we,
it is.
We attained. And there is discussion actually of further improvements in terms of things like screen filters, that you know, okay, colour great. Filters, which will go on there. But we built in text to speech, automatic text yes. to speech in the wow. in the textbooks, and that could be extended to other parts of services mm-hmm. as well. Now yeah. there are obviously screen readers, but if you can integrate that into an application, then you can actually yes. make it a bit more elegant in terms okay. of the way in which it works, and that's just going to get better and better. Yes. And there are now companies who are trying to, this is tangential but sort of related, there are businesses out there who are starting to sort of create mm-hmm. synthetic actor voices to use yes. for publishers to use as the basis for audiobooks. Well, yeah. if it gets to the point where the voices are good enough, then you've almost, you know, that as a means of accessing content in a way that really wasn't there before. And my middle son, who's studying now at university, he suffered terribly from dyslexia and
oh, really?
Was diagnosed quite late. And oh. I showed him that and he said, well, that would have been a completely different way of me accessing the content for
yes,
a book, which I would have loved, you know.
Yeah, it makes such a difference. I think there's one dyslexic friend I have, and she said at one stage she found a piece of technology which just changed her life and made her so emotional because she realized that if she'd had it before,
yes.
that her yeah. world would have been very different. And I think it's those kind of considerations. So one of the things we talk about in my in the group of people I've been chatting to is that if something is designed for someone who's dyslexic, someone who's perhaps partially sighted, someone who's deaf, or you know, all sorts of different disabilities that are out there, then actually that improves the user experience for everyone. And so in a way, kind of considering the niche use cases actually kind of ramps up the whole delivery of any piece of technology in a way.
Yeah, actually, I was trying to remember the name of the app that I found the other day, and the name eludes me. I'm trying to remember, I might have it here.
What does it do?
It's called Speechify.
Okay.
Speechify. And I really like it. It allows you to scan a piece of text using yeah. your phone, and it will, you can, if you choose the premium version, it will mm-hmm. It will read that out to you at different rates okay. and in different intonations, and it's using AI, but you can basically point it at anything, any piece wow. of text, and it will do it. And I just thought, you know, it's really a way of also digesting large tracts of information quickly as
yes.
a user. So you can do that. So that would be your business person who
yeah,
doesn't
yeah.
want to read a great tranche of stuff. Or it's there to help kids who are finding it difficult to access
yes.
content through the text. And I love it. Yeah. I mean, it was just a neat little thing. I found
amazing. That
it's been around
a great
for a while.
Addition. The other thing that I noticed, and something you mentioned actually, was the social interaction for pupils, particularly when they're attending the online school kind of environment under lockdown. Do you think there's room for a kind of, I don't know what I envision here, but some kind of way of gamification of learning? So my daughter at primary school had Doodle Maths access. I don't know if that's a resource you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And effectively it helps, it's kind of a tutor, online tutor. And each child gets a score and gets stars and, you know, awards at the level they achieve, but they also can see how they compare to other people in the class and kind of what the expected improvement might be for them. And I wondered if you thought about the kind of gamification of your resources at all, or whether these would be a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of rewards and having a sense of your achievement in relation to others' achievements is pretty well established. And certainly, you know, it is an incentive to improve, even that basic level. Gamification isn't just about that. I mean, gamification can mean a lot of different things, can't it? It can be learning through a game, an interaction like you have for kind of adult mind puzzles and things like that.
Yeah.
But it can also be about, as you say, I think kids, even ones who don't appear to care, kids do care quite a bit about how they're doing against their peers, I think.
Yes.
And if you give them a sense of that and a sense of incentive to do more or to engage, hopefully engage more at a deeper level and not just switch on the machine for 20 minutes. Then yes, absolutely. And I don't think educational publishers as a rule do it particularly well. And I would include us in that. There are some aspects of some of our services, like the reading scheme, where you get rewards for completing books and doing your tests and that kind of thing. So that's all positive. And I think
it can grow.
And I think that's the key thing that you can build into the people interfaces, certainly. And it can build off the same principles that give you things like the RAG reports and the progress over time reports for teachers. The balancing act is just not to make it a turn off for them, because they think it's tokenistic.
It has to be the right kind of reward. So one of the apps that my daughter uses, I keep talking about her, I apologize, but she's much more of an app user than me. So she uses Snapchat. And one of the things on Snapchat is they actually have points if they email their friends. So in a weird way, they're kind of rewarding social interaction.
Yeah.
And I have to say, that's probably the app she goes back to more than any other app. And I think education resource providers could probably learn from that in terms of engagement of their little users, you know, the young users, not just the teachers.
Yeah, I think there are principles of social interaction, social media that certainly could permeate. It's that tricky balancing act between not interfering with the fun aspects of your social interaction, your social media use in learning. I often think, you know, we aspire to get people to do things that actually they don't want to do in the context of their private lives or their private habits.
That said,
there are definitely principles that are there to incentivize. I think it's incentivization.
Yes.
Is actually a really good thing, but it can't be tokenistic. It's got to actually be something where they go, oh, okay, I've achieved that. Someone else has achieved better than I have. Why is it they've achieved better than I have? I mean, not saying who that person is, but just benchmarking yourself against
somebody,
you know,
similar to you.
So that you can say, well, I've got a sense of place, I've got a sense of attainment, but how do I actually improve?
Those
principles, I think, are great. And it's if that means interact more, if that means interact more, like your Snapchat analogy, then that's a good thing, probably.
It's a bit like KPIs in a business, where you get what you measure.
So
I think we can really learn from, you know, that experience and really think about the user and what they should be rewarded on, what kind of behavior we're trying to encourage. The other aspect of social interaction which has come up this year has been learning from conferences, really, where they've started to have a kind of virtual networking environment where you have an avatar that yes. walks in.
Yeah.
And so that's the other thing which you could have as a classroom environment, is essentially that each child, if you're online and at home, has an avatar.
Well, we have the, yeah, I've seen this with Smart actually. And they've got a kind of virtual exhibition app, you know, virtual conference mm-hmm. app where you can move from room to room.
Yes.
And you have avatars. I've only seen it briefly in action. It was nice because it emulated yeah. that feeling of wandering around and interacting. And certainly I think that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember there are lots of environments where this sort of thing's happened, isn't there? There was a Club Penguin craze years ago that some people might remember.
I don't remember that one, but...
Well, your daughter's younger than my kids, But, you know, there are lots of... I mean, these are environments. These are interactions with environments which are very familiar to online gamers.
Yes,
whether education, again... can really benefit or emulate mm-hmm. the feeling of sort of a community and that kind of thing, I don't know, through that kind of interaction. It's quite an high overhead to bear in terms of development and maintenance for what I don't, I mean, we'd have to talk to the customers. Would they actually value this thing? And do they want one space where they can go and do to use all the things they want to use from me and from other people? Or would they want your space that you've developed do they want to go to multiple places? Probably not. Yeah. So lots of questions in there. Again, not really a definitive answer, but it's I think it's going to be interesting to see how it develops.
So I have one more discussion point and one fairly small question. The discussion point that I was thinking about was, do you feel that given the level of online learning in lockdown, that it will fundamentally change the method of teaching? So the reason I ask this is because I'm very interested in Ken Robinson and his theories on education and the fact that the education system isn't really designed for our kids' future in terms of what they'll face in their future and what kind of jobs will be available for them and things. And one of the things Ken Robinson talks about is we don't just have a climate change crisis, we have a human potential crisis. That we're kind of shoehorning kids into a way of learning which A, doesn't prepare them for the future, but also can actually suppress their natural creativity and inventiveness, either by, you know, making them feel demoralized about their talents in those areas or kind of controlling the way they interact and behave in the classroom, which then carries through into work. So this is a big discussion point, but I wondered if you feel there's going to be a fundamental shift where you might have an in-person school and online school within a kind of state school environment in the future. That will radically change.
This is the pandemic has amplified mm-hmm. this discussion, but it's been going on for a long time.
Yes.
And I actually think before you start thinking about technology and what the pandemic represented as a challenge in terms of continuing mm-hmm. people's education. In relation to what you've just quoted from Ken Robinson, I think the more significant thing is how will people be assessed? Because the brutal fact is, if the measure of success for most kids is whether they can pass an exam, mm-hmm. and that becomes also a benchmark of success for the school through the performance league tables, then what are educationalists going to do? And I don't criticize anyone in that regard. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that if the measure of success for all stakeholders is essentially a grade on a piece of paper, then that will drive a lot of what is done. Now, obviously, within all of that, there is excellent practitioner or excellent practice on the part of teachers to infuse a love of learning whilst also getting to that successful outcome.
Yeah.
But I, you know, nothing else from this pandemic, there's got to be a reassessment probably of what constitutes academic success or what constitutes the abilities of one learner against another. And I think what you're really saying is, if you were just to base workplace performance on being able to pass exams, mm-hmm. then you wouldn't have productivity, you wouldn't have collaboration, you wouldn't have problem solving
exactly
and creativity and output and productivity. You would simply have pieces of paper.
Yeah.
And yet we have an education system that essentially promotes that notion.
Yeah. I completely agree. So maybe
the answer to your question is, if they change the way in which if the assessment regime is changed in such a way that we trust teachers more, mm-hmm. that there's less emphasis on hard knowledge-based skills and your ability to answer questions on them,
mm-hmm.
and it's more about collaboration.
Yes.
It's more about an outcome that really can only be arrived at a high level if you've mm-hmm. thought creatively and you've worked as a team and those kind of things, then maybe that's what would drive some of the innovation you're talking about in the teaching and learning getting there, you know, the systems that you use. So in the current state of affairs, I don't think it is going to fundamentally change that, no.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. One of the recent podcasts I've just issued actually is about someone who ran a startup in mental health, made, you know, a success of it, and as CEO decided he didn't like his role, and so actually decided to appoint someone else and step into another role. And the reason it interested me was because most people in their 20s, their ultimate aspiration is CEO. And so to find out when you get there that you don't actually like being one was a really interesting conversation to have. And that's why, in terms of human potential, you know, we need to diversify in order to solve the world's problems. And I apologize because I've been working in social change. So I'm very passionate about homelessness solutions, poverty solutions. And yes, it's well, this will sound very idealistic, but I believe solving global poverty is a prerequisite to world peace, which is a very fluffy concept. But in order to solve a global poverty, we really need to ensure that everyone gets a chance to be the best they can be. And in yes. education, I think that's an amazing aspiration, really.
Yeah, I think what you've alighted on is is sort of fairly core, isn't it? It's usually where there's hardship that tension and conflict arises.
Yeah.
And so if you are feeling, you know, in educational terms, if you're feeling dispossessed or you're feeling like you are failing because mm-hmm. you can't take a route that suits you, or that talks to your abilities, then mm-hmm. that can be terribly destabilizing and leads to disenfranchisement.
Exactly.
And I would agree with that. I think there are some major efforts going on to try and truly get parity of esteem for vocational qualifications. It'll be interesting to see whether that you asked about universities earlier. Some people had a miserable time at university, and that's not to blame universities mm-hmm. for it, but they have had a terrible time over the last couple of years, and they're spending large sums of money. And universities, and I do have some sympathy with this, saying, well, we've had to invest that money to ensure mm-hmm. that we could get continuity of learning, and we've had to upgrade our infrastructure and train our staff and do all those things. But the fact is that there are a lot of people who probably come out of university in the current cohort who are going to mm-hmm. think they didn't have a very satisfactory experience.
Yes, yes.
And I wonder whether...
Maybe.
Yeah, and I wonder whether kids coming through will actually, if they've got really good vocational alternatives, will say, actually, you know what? I'm going to go that different route. I don't have to do that.
So my nephew wants to start work now. He's 14. mm-hmm. And it's mainly because he is a techie geek, if you like, and is just so interested in programming, technical architecture, the future of technology, that he just kind of wants to jump across all the school subjects mm. and go straight for being one of those. I bought him a Raspberry Pi, so that kind of illustrates who he is, really. So it's very interesting, because I think the kids are going to kind of chomp at the bit to go faster, and will really want to. So my daughter's just chosen her options, so she was focused on, will these options make me successful in my future? And so if at 12 you're already thinking in that way, and also potentially frustrated at maybe the limitations of existing technology infrastructure, then you know, who knows where it's going to be in 5 years' time.
Well, in some senses, what she should be asking is what do I think is not going to make me successful in future as things stand today? But in 20 years' time, what do I think is going to make me successful? And if you had a different way of thinking about assessing that person's abilities and giving them options to go and explore those things, then you would liberate them to actually think in terms of what they think they can contribute because they're interested in it. So your nephew is already thinking in those terms, which is good.
Well, there's two things that I think cater for his desire to learn. One is I found a holiday course that you could do to learn Python in a week at 14, that kind of thing. And the other is the Dyson University of Invention, where he actually pays the fees of his students and teaches them, you know, the kind of workflows of how to invent something. And both of those kind of opportunities seem amazing.